This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week on Writer's Voice, two stories from the planet's front lines, the Amazon rainforest and the Arctic ice. Journalist Andrew Fishman joins us to talk about completing the posthumous book by Dom Phillips, How to Save the Amazon, A Journalist's Deadly Quest for Answers. Phillips was murdered in 2022 for reporting on the destruction of the rainforest, and this book is his legacy. Then we head north with writer Kieran Mulvaney. His book, Arctic Passages, Ice Exploration and the Battle for Power at the Top of the World, uncovers how centuries of ambition and today's climate crisis are colliding in the Arctic. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. Dom Phillips dedicated his life to uncovering the truth about the Amazon, its beauty, its people, and the forces tearing it apart. In 2022, he paid the ultimate price when he was murdered while reporting in the forest. His final book, How to Save the Amazon, has now been published posthumously, completed by journalist Andrew Fishman along with a team of fellow journalists. The book investigates the forces driving deforestation, agribusiness, illegal logging, mining, and organized crime, and highlights the activists and indigenous communities defending the forest. It's part investigation, part call to action, and it asks the question at the heart of our survival: what must we do to save the Amazon? Andrew Fishman is an investigative journalist based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. He led the creation of The Intercept Brazil, where he served as managing editor for many years and is now president. His reporting focuses on Brazilian politics, the environment, and the influence of multinational corporations. Andrew Fishman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How to Save the Amazon is both partially by Dom Phillips. It was a book that he was in the midst of writing when he was brutally murdered. He was a British journalist who dedicated his life to the Amazon and was killed in 2022 in an area called the Javari Valley, along with indigenous expert Bruno Pereira of FUNAI, which is the Brazilian agency that oversees indigenous affairs. You were among a group of writers, journalists, and activists who were assembled by Dom's wife, Alessandra, to complete his work. Let's first start with Dom. Tell us a little bit about him. How did he end up in Brazil, and what led to his passion for the Amazon?
Dom was this person that, you know, there's very few people that you meet in life that you see them and they're doing exactly the thing that they want to be doing, that they were meant to be doing. And Dom really loved being a journalist. He had such clarity about that. So he came to writing this book because first he was working as a freelance reporter, primarily for The Guardian in the last years, doing daily beat coverage. And at that time in Brazil, Bolsonaro had just won the presidency. And the coverage that The Guardian wanted and needed was, you know, daily coverage of crazy things that Bolsonaro was saying. And that gets really exhausting as a writer. You know, he's a reporter, he's a journalist, but he's a beautiful writer. And he was just getting a little bit tired of writing 400-word stories about horrible things that horrible people are saying. And he wanted to do something that felt more useful and more exciting and interesting. You know, he had started his career first as a music journalist in the UK. He founded a magazine about electronic music and was very successful at it. And he was actually offered this when the magazine was bought out by a larger publisher. He was offered the top job at the even bigger music magazine, which he told to me, he said, he called me a stupid American all the time. Stupid American, you wouldn't understand, you wouldn't know the brands I'm talking about. But it's basically like the Rolling Stone of the UK. And he turned down the job because he didn't want to be sitting at a desk worrying about budgets and doing office politics and all that. He wanted to be, you know, out in the field talking to people, writing stories. And so he quit and he left to be a freelancer. He gave up the company BMW and, you know, went to be a poor starving artist in the journalism world, basically. That he wrote, ended up writing a book about those DJs, and that book brought him to Brazil. That's where he finished his writing, and some of the subjects had gone there. And he just fell in love with the place. And so he decided to start a new life, basically, as a news reporter in Brazil, working his way up from, you know, whatever outlet that would take him to working at some the most reputable newsrooms. And he found this passion for the Amazon rainforest and the people that he met there. Always loved nature. It's, in my opinion, the Amazon is the most important story in Brazil right now. And it has massive global importance because it's getting close to the tipping point, the point of no return, where there'll be enough deforestation that it can no longer sustain itself and it will start turning into a savanna and maybe even to a desert, which would just be catastrophic for the entire world. It is, you know, the source of almost all of the rain in South America. Now, if, you know, Trump is worried about immigrants coming over to the border and how they're changing the country, imagine what would happen if the source of all of the rain in South America were to cease to exist or, you know, cut down by 80%. How many climate refugees do you think you would have? And not to mention all the knock-on effects in the climate. So Dom understood this big perspective, but he also really cared about the people that he met there and felt like they deserved a bigger voice than they had in the media, in the conversation, and that they deserved a better chance at a better life, because there are incredible solutions. There are people that are doing phenomenal things. This isn't an unsolvable problem. And so he decided that he wanted to write this book called How to Save the Amazon. And the original subtitle was Ask Those Who Know. It wasn't that he had the answers. It's that he knew many people who had many of the answers. And he wanted to make other people care about them and their lives and the issues that they were talking about just a little bit as much as he cared. Because, you know, you only take care of the things that you care about. And so creating that emotional connection through his, you know, his beautiful writing and these experiences that he had.
And that's so beautiful and very much in the spirit of the book and the way that he includes everyone in his sources, everyone on the ground. But before we get to that, I want to ask you a little bit about what that process was like to write a chapter. And it wasn't just you. You say that the people who wrote the chapters, the latter chapters of the book, engaged in an inner dialogue with Dom to carry his vision forward. How did you do that?
Yes, it was so difficult because every choice felt so monumental. You know, it's your friend's legacy. Everyone is very emotional about everything that happened. And you just didn't want to let him down, right? You wanted to live up to his very high standards, knowing that you're never going to do exactly as he would have. So we talked a lot. There's this group that Ale put together of journalists. There are four of us and his agent. And we spoke a lot about voice and, you know, do we try to, you know, replicate his voice and do some sort of, you know, like ghost whispering, basically, and try to pretend like we're him. It's going to be bad. Like, you just can't. That's not how writing works. And it would be this poor facsimile. And then, so, okay, well, how much of Dom's story do you put in? Obviously, you know, the fact that he was murdered changes a lot. How much are we going to be completely rigorous and loyal to what he had written, and how much freedom of range will people have? Certain political situations had changed dramatically. Bolsonaro was no longer president. Lula was. The droughts in the Amazon had gotten much worse, so maybe a little less hopeful than he was at the time. It was just incredibly paralyzing for me, at least, to live up to the standards. We decided that everyone should, first of all, we should select people that have a commitment to his legacy, not just the biggest Amazon experts, the most famous Amazon experts. We wanted people that knew him and cared about him and felt that moral responsibility to honor his vision. You know, there's plenty of people that are experts in Amazon that disagree, right? And so we wanted to make it Dom's book and not a compendium of random thoughts and points of view. But we said that everyone needed to write in their own voice with their own style and try to make it clear what it was that he was trying to do in that chapter. And so everyone did it in their own way, gave a little piece of who Dom was or what he was trying to do in that chapter. Some people were able to talk to his sources that he spoke to during the research for that chapter and add that little behind the scenes element. I had spoken to Dom a lot about this book as he was conceiving of it and very much encouraged him to put himself in it, because reporters and newspaper, hard news reporters are always told, indoctrinated to not put themselves. You're not the story. The story is the story. So, like, leave yourself out of it. It's not about you. But when you're doing a narrative book and you're trying to make this emotional connection, you are everyone's eyes, right? You are the reader's eyes. So it's interesting. And it's a useful tool to be able to include the things that you felt and saw and the perceptions and you know, serve to allow people to find themselves in your shoes for a second. And so he was uncomfortable with this, but he knew that he had to do it. And he ended up doing it, but it was something that he struggled with a bit. But it sort of, in my mind, gave us more permission to put ourselves in, put him in, because I know that, you know, he would hate that this book about the Amazon became about him. And in large part, it's not about him. You know, it's about his vision and the work that he was doing. But he definitely, he wanted people to connect emotionally to this issue, to the story. And he became international news. His murder became international news. And a lot of people opened up their hearts because of that. So we felt that it was fitting to include him.
So tell us about how this book came together, because Dom Phillips had already mostly written, well, at least written the first draft of the first five chapters, but at least half of the book was just in the form of notes. So how did this come together and why?
We knew from the very beginning, I feel like many, many people had the same idea at the same moment. We didn't even really need to discuss it, that this book needed to be published. That was a given, and everyone was determined that his murder was not going to silence his vision and his mission. I was in contact with Ale, his wife, from as soon as we found out that he was missing and strategizing and all of the things. Suddenly she was thrust into the middle of this, you know, international story, and there's all these press and people approaching her, and it was all very overwhelming. But part of the concern was that we didn't know if the Bolsonaro government was going to try to criminalize Dom. They were already trying to blame this on him, saying that shouldn't have been there, that he was being careless, which was not true. And so we weren't sure if there was going to be, you know, a police search order, a raid on his house. Maybe they would criminalize Ale as well to silence her. So when she came to Rio for the funeral, where I live, I met her at the airport with my wife, and I asked her to bring a suitcase with all of his notes, including his hard drives, his computers, and he had dozens of reporters' notebooks from the field from the last 12 years. And so she brought them to me for safekeeping. I was able to get into the hard drive and see that he was extremely organized, extremely structured, which made this much easier. And also, he was very bad at encryption. I found notes of his from a conversation he had with me where I was teaching him how to encrypt hard drives. And fortunately, he didn't follow through on the backups. He did on his computer. And so to this day, I still haven't been able to open it. But I was able to get his backups, which were meticulous. And we will see that he had all of this work. I mean, dozens of interviews, everything with a photo of each interviewee, so he could describe their faces. The notes that he had, you know, everything was there in folders and just perfectly done. It made it much, much easier to imagine doing this. The harder part was his notebooks were written in hieroglyphics. You know, imagine a guy leaning against a tree in the Amazon or on a boat, you know, scribbling in a notebook as someone's talking very, very fast in a foreign language. And you can imagine just how difficult it was for you. It took me about 5 hours of staring at them to finally start to be able to piece them together. And we photographed every single page of every single notebook and put them into a cloud folder so that the collaborators could access them together with his digital files. We decided that, there's lots of choices to make, editorial choices. Do we want to just publish what he had done? Because he had done basically all of the research, right? He was on his way home. He was going to get on a plane, get on another plane, go home, kiss his wife, and then lock himself in his office at his apartment and just write for like 3 or 4 months. The rest was basically done. But the chapters, not so much. So the first few, right, versions 6 and 7 of the intro and the chapter one, but then the versions kept getting lower and lower until the fourth chapter, you knew that this was not what he was planning to publish. He still was had a lot of work to do. And then the notes also sort of diminished as you went along deeper into the book. So the next chapter was actually very well structured. You knew exactly what he was thinking about doing, how he would do it, if it would change, your notes. You don't always follow your notes. But by the time I got to like chapter 8, the one that I wrote about international finance, he had like 3 sentences, 4 links. One of them was an article I wrote, and that was it. So you really, what do you do? I knew that he had told me, and he told his wife, that he had no idea what he was going to do for that chapter. It was the one that he was most afraid of because it's just so big. So we decided that we did not want to just publish what he had written, that we should complete the work. We decided that following his spirit, we needed to raise the funds so that every contributor who wrote a chapter had to go out into the field to retrace his steps or do additional reporting in the way that he would have done. And we also felt that it was important that this was a collaborative project of many people. We could have had one person finish the whole rest of the book, but it didn't feel right because when he died, there was this incredible movement where all of these journalists that were in Brazil, that were had previously been there, his friends, people who knew of him, they all came together and wanted to immediately help with the search. And, there was this collective spirit. And he was someone who had created a culture change in the Rio foreign journalist scene when he first got here about 15 years ago. At the time when he got here, it was very competitive. People didn't share sources or phone numbers or anything, really. Everyone's competing against each other. And he, along with a few others, created a happy hour, a monthly happy hour, where everyone would go to the same bar and drink beers together and, tell tales, and ended up creating this environment. Then it became a WhatsApp group, created this environment where people became friends, they became collaborators. And the group to this day exists. And people are always asking for sources and phone numbers and tips, and they're sharing and trading. And so we felt that he's someone that creates community. There was this big community that came together to support him. And so we wanted the book to be created by a community as evidence that you can't kill a journalist and silence him, because we are going to come together and make sure that that work continues.
And he went to the Javari Valley. Tell us about that place. How did he come to embark on, what the group that's published this has in the subtitle, A Journalist's Fatal Quest for Answers?
Sure. The Javari Valley is one of the most remote places on Earth. It has the largest concentration of uncontacted indigenous groups in the world. And it's the size of a European country. It's gigantic. It sits in the far west, northwest of Brazil, on the border with Colombia and Peru. And because of that location on the border, there's a lot of illegal smuggling. There's gangs that are increasingly becoming active in the region, and they have, vertical integration. So they will do drug smuggling from Peru and Colombia, and they'll also do illegal fishing or illegal mining, all sorts of contraband and corruption that happens when you have this lack of state power. And during the Bolsonaro years, he got rid of or dramatically reduced the influence of state power, the law and order that exists in that region, because he wanted to open it up for the illegal mining and for the deforestation, because he's an anti-environmentalist. So the Javari Valley became a place that was already quite dangerous and became extremely dangerous for people that were trying to defend the area. Dom learned about this place, or he knew about this place, but he was invited to go through contacts that he had covering other indigenous groups in the Amazon. And they, one of his sources, recommended him to the leader of Univaja, which is like the consortium of indigenous groups in the area that came together to have political representation for the indigenous peoples of the Javari Valley. And they recommended Dom and said, you should really talk to this British journalist. He's the real deal. And he's here to help. And you should invite him to talk about what's going on there. Now, this is something very rare. You know, a lot of indigenous leaders are very skeptical of journalists, Brazilian journalists, foreign journalists, because they've been burned so many times. Anyone who's been the subject of reporting knows how exposed you are. You know, these people are putting your life in their hands, and a little carelessness or a little malice can really cause big problems. And they experienced that. So the person that he spoke to, Beto Marubu, who was the leader of Univaja at the time and was formerly a FUNAI employee, he listened to his colleagues, even though he's rather skeptical of foreign journalists, and he invited him in to go with a man named Bruno Pereira, who was a white Brazilian indigenous who worked for FUNAI, but had left temporarily during the Bolsonaro years. So when he was there, when Dom went to visit him in 2018 for the first time, and again on this fateful trip in 2022, Bruno had stepped away from his job at FUNAI because Bolsonaro was trying to put him in a basement somewhere to collect dust while the area was getting ravaged. So he worked with Univaja to come together to create this indigenous group that was monitoring their own territory, doing what the government agency should be doing, but was negligent. So they were using GPS and drones and photography and creating proof that could stand up in court and be sufficient enough to force government action or have some sort of accountability. So Dom went there to learn about these activities that they were doing. He fell in love with the place. He became very good friends with Bruno Pereira, the then FUNAI guide who left FUNAI. And he decided that for this book, this was one of the big reasons that he wrote this book, because of that trip. It was so inspirational to him. And he decided that he needed to go back. In 2022, when he went, he was already over budget. He was taking a long time in this book. He really needed to get it done. But he refused to give up taking this trip because as a writer, he felt that the best journalism has to be done in person. You have to smell what people are smelling, see what they're seeing, get those little details that you can't get over the phone. Even though I said, but you already know these people. You've already met them. He said, yes, but things have changed so much in these 4 years from when I went then and now. I need to go back. It was the supreme goal. And he went. And unfortunately, Bruno, his guide, was targeted by illegal fishermen. They were ambushed and he was shot with a shotgun. And Dom was the witness. They didn't know who he was, really. But they couldn't let him live. And so he was also shot and killed.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with investigative journalist Andrew Fishman about Dom Phillips' posthumous book, How to Save the Amazon, A Journalist's Deadly Quest for Answers. Fishman and a team of other journalists completed Phillips' book after his murder by opponents in the Amazon. And it was so shocking. I mean, I remember when that happened. You spoke earlier about how he said the solution to the crisis is to ask the people who know. And that approach meant listening deeply to the indigenous people, to those who were even, among the people who have very little contact with the outside world. It also included the illegal fishermen or fishers. He really wanted to talk to all the people on the ground. Talk about his vision, how bringing those really disparate voices, voices that were in contradiction to each other, together, informed his vision of the solutions.
Thank you. That's a great question. Dom had a view that I share based on his travels that many people from abroad. First of all, most people in Brazil have never been to the Amazon, never will. So they have just this idealized vision of what it is. And definitely most people abroad will never go. And they largely have this vision of a bunch of trees, this big, unblemished, perfect forest that goes on forever. That's not really how it is. There's so much deforestation. 70% of the people live in cities. And the fact is that a lot of people that he met that were doing illegal mining or working on cattle farms that were on deforested land, or, you know, people that were doing illegal fishing, they were doing that because the way that the economy is structured, there weren't a lot of opportunities. There aren't a lot of opportunities in many of these communities that are very remote. The state does not really reach them, very rarely and very poorly. So your choices are to take care of your family and hopefully give them a better future, are very often the only way to make a little bit of extra money is doing these activities that are destructive. And many of them know that this is the case. They know that this is not good for their homes and the places they live and for the long-term survival of their communities. But they don't really have, or they don't feel that they have other options. And he was really sympathetic about that and said, we have no right to judge these people for the choices that they're making. They are not the ones that are responsible for this. The people that are responsible are the politicians that are not creating enforcement, that are not creating development policies, that are creating more opportunities, economic opportunities that are sustainable. Because we know that, you know, one of the worst ways to make money in the Amazon is by chopping it all down and putting some cows in. The amount of money that you make is so tiny per acre per year. And you can make more by doing sustainable agroforestry, where you're having a mix of native plants that produce fruits and vegetables that you can, nuts that you can sell. The problem is that that is more of a small-scale, non-industrialized form of economic activity. So it's great for local communities. It's great for Brazil, and it sustains the Amazon, which is great for the world. But Wall Street's not going to make any money off of that. So instead, because of the political scenario that we find ourselves in and the economic scenario that we find ourselves in, there is investment for and subsidies for cattle ranching that comes in and deforests, and they get amnesty for the crimes that were committed. And then once they deplete that soil, which needs the plants to maintain itself, it quickly depletes, and then they turn it into, you know, soy or some other monocrop culture. And it's just so dumb, honestly. So the people that are in these communities, the people that are actually doing the work, they're not making these choices. They're making rational economic decisions based on the situation that they find themselves in. And many of them lament it, including, you know, some of the cattle ranchers that are a bit more well-to-do and maybe do have some more options. And so he felt that it was important that any solution needed to consider these people, whether independent of what they're doing now. They deserve a better life. They deserve some sort of stability and quality of life that all citizens are entitled to. And if we were to exclude that and just say, as many people who are very distant from the Amazon, like, oh, just, you know, shut it down, just kick out all the people and turn it into a national park. Well, there's 20 million people that live there in the Brazilian Amazon, 30 million in the greater Amazon. And many of them have lived there for many, many generations. They're not leaving, and it doesn't make sense for them to leave. And they don't have to leave to sustain it. But we need to have a more humanist approach to the issue if we're going to solve it. And that's why he wanted to make this emotional travelogue.
So the fact is that he was murdered by fishers who were trying to stop those who were trying to protect the area, in fact. So how to come to those kinds of solutions? What did he see as the way to change the mentality or to bring these conflicting interests together, since there's so much violence that has attended, you know, these competing interests?
It's one of the great ironies of his death that he was there compassionately with a mind to help the people that ended up seeing him as an enemy and killing him. Had they known who he really was and what he stood for, maybe it would have been different, but they didn't. They didn't know. You know, they saw what Bruno and the group that he was working with were doing as a threat because it was trying to stop illegal fishing and illegal exploitation of the indigenous land. And they were the ones that were doing that because they felt that that was the only thing that they could do to make a little bit of money. And in that sense, they weren't entirely wrong because there really isn't, in the short term, much hope of new opportunities to come through. And they need to eat today, right? What Don was trying to do was help create that political pressure so that maybe 5 years from now or 3 years from now or less, that there would be more investment into alternatives so that they wouldn't have to see as this is the only way that we can make money. And these people, this outsider with his indigenous partners, are trying to take food out of my mouth. The question of the Amazon is, it's so simple. Imagine you're using a telephoto lens and a camera, and you zoom in at certain lengths, and everything is just so clear. You know, the solutions are so simple. But then you zoom out a little bit, and suddenly you see the context in which that was, and suddenly it becomes very complex. And maybe, you know, it could even feel impossibly complex. It all depends on the zoom that you're looking at it with. What's responsible for 80 to 90% of deforestation in the Amazon is cattle ranching. Deforestation is the thing that could cause the tipping point of the Amazon and create this great destruction. So the global economy, the Brazilian economy, does not run on beef. We could stop producing all of the beef in the Amazon today, tomorrow, and there would be economic shocks. There would be people who would no longer be able to afford beef. But it's not like, you know, decarbonizing the economy. It's much more, that's much more complex. But the politics of it are very complex. The cattle ranchers, the agro business, they run the show in Brasilia. They run the Congress. And, you know, Lula government came in after Bolsonaro, and they are also beholden to the agro lobby. And if they were to try to go against their wishes, then they would not be able to do a whole lot. So that's what makes it much more complex and makes it so that these people that killed him found themselves in the situation that they are in, unless something big changes, will probably continue to find themselves in that situation for many years to come. Lula can be very frustrating for a lot of people who follow him because he says a lot of things when he's running for office. And then when he gets into office, he doesn't really follow through on many of them. And that's in large part because of the political context that he's in. In Brazil, you don't have two parties, the Democrats and Republicans. You have dozens of parties. And the majority of them, the biggest blocks, are called the Centrão, the big center. And they're not really centrists. They're actually the oligarch parties, the old established moneyed interests that have controlled Brazilian politics forever and continue to. So when Lula wins, the Centrão becomes part of his coalition. And they get concessions and they get ministries and they get control of certain parts of the budget. And then when Bolsonaro wins, they become part of his coalition as well. So they're not really loyal allies. So that really limits the maneuverability that someone like Lula has, even if he has the best intentions. This trend has only gotten worse. The far-right elements and the Centrão have become more powerful than ever as compared to his previous terms in office. And so the maneuverability is much narrower. So there's a bill that was just passed recently called the Devastation Bill. That's what it's been nicknamed, which would get rid of a huge part of environmental approvals on projects, new development projects. So if you want to create a cattle farm or a small mine, you used to have to go through many stages of environmental approvals that could take years and often would get declined. Under this new bill, you would just have to do self-evaluation. So you can imagine what that would do. It would open up the floodgates for really destructive development. And Lula said that he was not going to veto the bill. There's questions as to why, but my guess is that it's because he knows that he doesn't have the power. Even if he were to veto, it would get approved again, which would show his weakness, and it would also alienate a big part of his base that he needs for other policies. So yes, Lula is better than Bolsonaro, but things are still quite dire. There's been many developments under his administration that are really concerning. Maybe they're a little slower than they would have been under Bolsonaro. Rhetorically, he's, you know, much more positive, and there are some positive things that are happening. But in large part, he's being really controlled by these vested interests that run the country and have run the country. And so one of the things that in my chapter was about international finance and financing, I emphasize that many of the decisions, the people that are most responsible for making decisions that will determine the outcome of the Amazon have never stepped foot in the Amazon, never will. because international banks, if you're a cattle rancher in Brazil in the Amazon, that's your business. That's 100% of your money, and you're going to fight like hell to make sure that you can keep doing it. If you're BlackRock, the percentage of the profits, your company's profits for the year that come from cattle ranching in the Amazon is just, it's infinitesimally small. It's irrelevant. I mean, you could blink and it could be it could go away and you never even notice it. So there's much more hope in my mind to pressure these investors that are fueling this destructive development than there is perhaps in the Congress that is completely locked in with cattle. When Bolsonaro was so gung-ho about deforestation, there was a lot of concern internationally, and Europe was particularly concerned, and they started putting forward legislation. They were talking about boycotts, you know, companies, supermarkets saying, we're not going to buy Brazilian beef anymore because it's too tainted. And that scared them. That actually did make them change their behavior, soften their tone. And so I think that international investors and international customers have a huge amount of power that they need to wield more and more responsibly.
And are there organizations that are putting that pressure on international investors? Because this is very much like the whole move to defund climate destruction.
Yeah, the Trump administration's win and their whole push against anything that has the word climate in it is extremely troubling. And it is going to have big knock-on effects. There's a concept called ESG, environmental social governance, in investing, that was a push to have more socially conscious and sustainable practices. In reality, and I read about this in my chapter, in reality, it's not about saving the planet. It's about the future sustainability of your investments. So, you know, it's being framed as this pie in the sky, do-gooding, lefty communist plot to destroy capitalism by people like Trump. But in reality, it was about making sure that if you're investing in cattle, that 10 years from now, you'll still be able to turn a profit from it because your practices aren't, you know, making your investments no longer viable. So it's really quite in the interest of the capitalists that to have ESG, and yet he's made it this dirty word that's created a lot of pressure for people to step away from it. And we know the power of the U.S. economy, U.S. investment, and the fact that so much of the global trade is dollarized. And so that's a weapon that the U.S. government can use. You know, anyone who trades in dollars, which is basically everyone, can be sanctioned or penalized for not following Trump's lead on this. Europe is still doing some ESG measures. There is a deforestation bill that passed in the EU that would require supply chain monitoring of goods purchased from the Amazon or tropical forests, and that if you don't follow it, then you could be fined a percentage of your total revenue in Europe, which for like a major soy trader, that's a lot of money. We're talking about billions of dollars in fines, potentially. That's the sort of measure that needs to happen. The EU has also been clamping down on regulating what ESG means, what green means. There's people that are going out there like JBS, the biggest cattle company in the world that's Brazilian based, and saying, oh, we're doing a $1 billion green bond. And when you look at what it means, you're supposed to get preferential rates because it's sustainable practices. When you look at what they're promising, it's actually just all air. It's just a normal bond, but they're calling it green. So the EU is trying to do measures that have been pushed forward by civil society and pressure groups to say, let's create standardized terms and penalize people for abusing them so that we can create more consistency and credibility for these measures. In the U.S., there's a group called Mighty Earth. It's an NGO they took legal action against JBS in the U.S. because they were trying to get listed on the New York Stock Exchange so they could get more capital. And they took legal action about the many fraud, instances of fraud and abuse that they've had over the years to try to block them from getting that approval. It was getting held up under Biden, and now with Trump, they've gotten the approval that they needed. So there are groups that are still fighting. There are measures that are still taking place, but it's now a much more difficult terrain because of the U.S. political situation. But you got to keep fighting, because if we don't, if the Amazon is not saved, then I can promise you that it's not just going to be bad for people's investments. It's going to be catastrophic for all of humanity. And that's why we need to care. That's why we need to keep working, because Don believed that it was possible, that it is possible to save the Amazon. The solutions are there. The politics just need to change. And that's what I hope that people take away from this book and feel inspired despite the cloud of doom that looms over. That should give us the urgency. But we should still have positivity that there are relatively simple things that can be done to make it much, much better.
And this is such an important book to help that happen. Andrew Fishman, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. This has just been such an interesting and important conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Fishman is an investigative journalist based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. We talk with journalist Kieran Mulvaney about how global warming and geopolitical rivalries are converging in the Arctic. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Well, from the lush green of the Amazon, we travel to the frozen white of the Arctic, a region warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. In his book, Arctic Passages, writer Kieran Mulvaney traces the history of and present-day conflicts in the Arctic, from the perilous journeys of early explorers to a high-stakes arena of global power struggles in one of the harshest environments on Earth. As the ice melts at alarming rates, the Arctic has become both a bellwether of climate change and a battleground for nations seeking power and resources. Kieran Mulvaney, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So in 1993, you went to Antarctica on an expedition, and you say that that visit set in motion a love affair with the other polar region, the Arctic. Why?
Well, there are a pair of volcanoes, one active, one not, on Antarctica, believe it or not, called Mount Erebus and Mount Terror. And they're named after two ships that Sir James Clark Ross took on an expedition to Antarctica in the 19th century that proved to be an incredibly successful expedition, did an awful lot of charting of the coastline of Antarctica. And those two ships ended up being used in an effort to find the Northwest Passage through the Canadian Arctic, which is a passage from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And they became lost and their crews died. And there was this one morning in Antarctica where we were drifting quite close to those volcanoes. And the amazing thing about the Antarctic is the light can play a trick on you and just the wispiest of clouds can come in and suddenly you only have a very short field of view, and then they can disappear and suddenly you can see for miles. And that's kind of what happened to me one morning with Mount Erebus. I was out on the deck of the ship quite early and vision was perfect and I could see Mount Erebus and it was absolutely stunning and absolutely beautiful. And it started me on this road of wanting to learn more about Mount Erebus and then why it was called Erebus and then about the ships. And I became really captivated with the fate of both the Erebus and Terror. And so I sort of resolved to learn over the years more about that. And that's ultimately what led me to go through the Northwest Passage a few years ago and to write a book about the region.
It's a very increasingly important region to the world. You were also on one of your expeditions I don't know if you'd call it an expedition. You were with the Greenpeace. What was the name of that ship again?
The Arctic Sunrise?
Yeah, the Arctic Sunrise. Tell us a little bit about that and why you were on there.
Well, I spent a spell working for Greenpeace and then went back a couple of times as a consultant. While I was working for them, and this is why I was in the Antarctic in the first place, I spent some time chasing after whaling ships for them and then was occasionally asked back. Sometimes they had space while I was a freelance journalist. They asked me if I wanted to be on board for that trip. This one particular trip, which was my first real trip to the Arctic, was when I was freelancing and Greenpeace was putting together a lengthy trip to the Alaskan and Russian Arctic and asked a number of researchers on board. They were planning to visit Alaska Native villages to ask residents there what they knew about climate change, hoping to provide a platform to allow these scientists to do research on seabirds and mammals along the ice edge. And they had space for a freelance journalist and they asked me if I wanted to go along. And so but it was for 3 months I was on board and I got to see the polar bears for the first time. I was able to spend time in the Arctic at length for the first time. And that really was then kick things onto another level. And I came back from that trip. I was living in Washington, D.C. And I came back from that trip and decided to move to Alaska, which I did for 8 years. And that's when I really started to focus on the Arctic.
Now, you've mentioned in that answer a couple of things that are really important themes here. First of all, they were Russia. You mentioned Russia. That's a very key part of the story. Climate change and the indigenous peoples who are up there, the Inuits. This is not the same Arctic that it was in the 19th century when that trip of the Erebus and Terror made their expedition. Talk about climate change, which you call the adversary that nobody wants to deal with. Talk about some of the changes that are happening now.
Yeah, well, it's really profound in the Arctic for a number of different reasons, you know, partly, you know, connected with where it is and the angle at which, you know, solar radiation hits it. The Arctic is warming by some estimates 4 times faster than the rest of the globe. So whereas we're starting to see in like temperate areas, the impacts of climate change, particularly in the likes of wildfires and extreme weather events, things like that. It's been an issue in the Arctic for a bit longer, and the pace of change is increasing. One of the biggest things we're seeing is a loss of ice, and particularly sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. And that's much more important than perhaps most people might think about. We might think, oh, ice is disappearing. Oh, great. You know, whatever. That just means the Arctic's going to be a much more pleasant place to be. But the entire Arctic ecosystem and indeed the way of life of Inuit people is absolutely based around sea ice and the existence of sea ice. The presence of algae in the ice when it melts in spring, those algae flood the Arctic Ocean and provide a whole bunch of resources for life to bloom throughout the Arctic. It's what enables the Arctic to live and to thrive for the rest of the year. So you have, you know, fish feed off the algae, larger fish eat those fish, seals eat the larger fish, polar bears eat the seals, whales are involved, people are involved, and all of that is at risk and all of that is in danger of disappearing as a direct result of climate change. So we're seeing changes to indigenous people's ways of life. We're seeing changes to wildlife populations. We're seeing changes to the health of wildlife that is there. We're seeing potentially more negative impacts between some Arctic wildlife and humans because wildlife is now struggling to find the food that it wants. And in that regard, I'm specifically talking about polar bears, which increasingly are walking into Arctic communities in search of food. And that obviously is creating all kinds of potential conflict situations. We're seeing wildfires as well up in the Arctic. It's just a profound and fundamental change to the very nature of what the Arctic is. I interviewed a while back a fellow who's a scientist who specialized in the study of ringed seals, which is the species of seal that polar bears feed on and primarily. And every year he has gone back to study ringed seals on the sea ice for decades. And he said to me he's really annoyed about the fact that he had hoped always that his son would be able to come with him and then might be interested in doing that research himself. And he goes, that's never going to happen now because by the time he's my age, that environment just isn't going to be there for him to study. So the amount of change in the Arctic is really noticeable and really profound and very meaningful for Arctic ecosystems and for Arctic peoples.
And even for more than Arctic peoples, because Europe and the United States are threatened by the progressive or the slowing down and possibly stopping of the Gulf Stream, the Atlantic meridional overturning. It affects all of us. What happens to the Arctic, doesn't it?
It does, actually. It absolutely does. The science is still a little bit in dispute, but it's possible that a contributor to the fact that even in the middle of a warming world, some of us in more temperate zones will get these kind of Arctic blasts of cold weather, extreme cold weather during the winter, might be as a consequence of Arctic warming, because you have greater amounts of warm air sort of rising and disrupting Arctic air patterns that normally have kept that cold weather in there. And as you talked about, yeah, the Arctic meridional overturning circulation potentially could change or even halt completely. And the reason that there is concern being expressed about that is because of the loss primarily of freshwater ice in Greenland. As Greenland is melting, the freshwater component of some of these northern sea waters is changing. And there is very great concern about what that might end up doing, how that's going to change the whole nature of currents and overturning in these Arctic oceans. Now, if that were to happen, one ironic consequence of a greater warming in northern regions would be that places like, for example, the United Kingdom could conceivably get colder initially, because it's being kept far warmer for its latitude than really one would expect. If that current becomes disrupted, then you get places like the UK become much colder, you get other places are much warmer. You just have a massive, rapid disruption of the system as we've known it for all these many years.
You mentioned how this is disrupting the Inuits. One of the things you talk about in this book, Arctic Passages, Ice Exploration and the Battle for Power at the Top of the World, Kieran Mulvaney, is you contrast the meaning of the Arctic for the Inuit peoples and the other indigenous peoples of the Arctic with the approach to the Arctic of Western civilization, let's say. Talk a little bit about the differences in the meaning of the Arctic to those two different groups.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. I was thinking about this just the other day, actually, because I think it's a really important element in how we approach this. You know, like on the one hand, as I was just talking about, sea ice, for example, is so extremely important to Inuit and other native peoples. It's not only a platform on which to hunt. It provides the boost for the marine ecosystem on which they depend. It also provides a means of transportation. It's a means of communication. It's extremely important. It's a fundamental aspect of their way of life. To the Western world, it's an enemy. It's an obstacle. It's danger. Because traditionally, particularly over the last couple of centuries, the Western world, when it's looked at the Arctic, it's looked at it as a means of, as a passageway, if you will, from east to west. And ice gets in the way of that. And ice blocks ships, ice crushes ships, ice sinks ships, ice causes people to die. And so for me, I think a little disgust, but I think really fundamentally important underpinning of how we approach the Arctic and change in the Arctic compared to what it means for the people who are there is that fundamental difference, in that it's been hard for me while studying this to not escape the conclusion that when folks in the West look at a situation in which sea ice is disappearing, their response is, thank goodness, we've been wanting to get rid of that ice for ages. This is great. This is the Arctic we've been looking for. Whereas it's an absolute disaster for those who have been living there for millennia. And I really think that, you know, it's not talked about a lot, but the more that I wrote about this and the more I thought about this, the more that I feel that that's like a really fundamental thing. And you look at how ice has been described in Western literature. You know, for example, you know, Frankenstein was written in the aftermath of the Erebus and Terra disappearing and tales coming out of the crew on that ship, on those ships, having to indulge in cannibalism in a futile attempt to survive. And people forget about it now, but the beginning and end of Frankenstein is actually set in the Arctic. The ship comes across the monster in the Arctic, and it just describes the Arctic. It sort of does this parallel between the monster and the Arctic regions, describes them in these tremendously negative terms. And I really do think that that really affects our ability to get people motivated to work on the Arctic. Because, yes, there's too much of a sense of sea ice is in the way. It's an enemy, whereas it isn't. It's something to be protected.
So that situation is obviously changing. In fact, you start the book with an incident in the Suez Canal in 2021 when this gigantic container ship, the Ever Given, got stuck. And the Russian authorities used the opportunity to counsel what?
Well, so the sort of basis of the book is it sort of looked at historically when folks, and particularly Europeans, but also Americans and others in the West, have been looking to, you know, use the Arctic as a passage from Atlantic to Pacific and vice versa. It's through two areas, the Northwest Passage through Arctic Canada and the Northeast Passage across the top of Scandinavia and Russia. And the Russians have been very much developing their part of that Northeast Passage that they call the Northern Sea Route. They have been building infrastructure. They have been building icebreakers. They have been trying to encourage international shipping to travel through there. And so what the Russian authorities did as the Suez Canal was completely jammed up was say, look, we've got our own sea route and it's going to be much bigger than the Suez Canal. It's going to be bigger than the Panama Canal. The route is shorter than going through the Panama Canal or the Suez Canal. This is what you need to be looking at. We're going to be the transit route of the future. Now, it's a long, 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 long way away from that. And Russia has been shooting itself in the foot in that regard ever since the invasion of Ukraine, because other countries don't want to deal with it. But it very much took that opportunity to say, hey, the future of shipping, the future of transportation, just the future generally, is going to be in a melting Arctic. And so, yeah, they absolutely took that opportunity to tell people about that and to try to encourage people to think about using the Northeast Passage a long, long, long way off from that actually being viable, even notwithstanding what, you know, Russia's self-isolation as a result of its foreign policy. But yeah, that was definitely an opportunity that they did not miss.
Well, you mentioned the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians as one political, geopolitical factor. But there's also competition between the various, you know, entities. You talk about eight Arctic nations. There's the U.S., there's Canada, there's Russia. I didn't know that China was part of the Arctic, but China is also engaged with this. Talk a little bit about the competition between these nations and what that bodes for geopolitical stability.
Right, indeed. Well, there are eight countries that border the Arctic. In many respects, the most, for want of a better phrase, most important ones are the largest ones, the USA, Canada, and Russia, although Denmark, as the quote unquote, you know, the de facto guarantor of security for Greenland, you know, is also a factor in there. There are interesting differences of opinion about many aspects of the Arctic among these countries, and it makes for some odd bedfellows. So, for example, the Northwest Passage that I mentioned goes through the islands of the Canadian Arctic Archipelago. Canada insists that it's their internal waters and that they can govern and regulate what ships travel through and what don't. The United States says that's not true. They say it's international waterway and anyone can use it if they so wish. Interestingly, Russia sides with Canada on this interpretation of international law because they say also their own waters and the Northeast Passage are their own to do with as they wish. So there's disagreement there. China, interestingly, sides with the United States on this and says that they should be international waterways. But, you know, you mentioned China. What does China have to do with any of this? China's nowhere near the Arctic. Well, China takes a long-term view of things. It has long-term planning. We plan maybe to the next election, and then we figure every policy that's been followed over the last 4 years is going to get reversed. China has the luxury of being able to look very far forward and plan very far forward. And what China is seeing is that there's a potential for the Arctic to become sea ice free. China is, by some measures, probably the second largest merchant shipping fleet in the world. They're thinking about shipping. They're thinking about ways they can save money. They're thinking about ways that they can also have some influence. They want to be taken seriously as a major nation. So they see the likes of the US and Canada and Russia preparing for an ice-free Arctic. And they're like, we need to do that too, to the extent that China already has more icebreakers than the United States does. And despite its philosophical disagreements on the issue with Russia, is the one other country that actually uses the Northeast Passage above Russia for its commercial cargo. So China is sort of taking this long-term view. And so what's happening is you have numerous countries looking at the prospect of an ice-free Arctic. And instead of focusing on what that entails and the potential damage that can ensue, they're putting a lot of effort into thinking, well, how can we benefit from this and who's going to benefit the most? So you have Canada, for example, talking up the Northwest Passage, Russia talking up the Northeast Passage, China thinking about, well, maybe we can dodge all of this and not worry about Canada, not worry about Russia, or maybe we can figure out a sea route right across the North Pole, and then we'd be in a great position. And then added to that, you then have countries going, well, if all this seabed is going to be exposed, we better make sure we claim this territory and make sure it's ours just in case there's anything down there that we may want. So bit by bit, you have countries sort of reacting to the moves that the others are making. Russia is militarizing its northern Arctic coast, partly out of its own paranoia. And then you get the United States responding to that. And then you also have the US saying, well, if China wants to be involved, then we need to increase our military capacity. And you just have one of these situations that I worry is just going to snowball unnecessarily, and that you have these countries looking at a melting Arctic, and the US is like, well, China's getting involved, therefore we've got to get involved. And if China and Russia are involved, they're going to bring weapons, so we better have more weapons. And Russia's doing the same, and China's doing the same. And I worry that for absolutely no good reason whatsoever, we could end up in a kind of situation where we have these different countries glowering at each other, mistrusting each other in the Arctic, and some kind of nonsense breaks out, and we have an entirely unnecessary conflict in the Arctic. Whereas what we should be doing is not preparing for an ice-free Arctic, not figuring out who can win a war in an ice-free Arctic, not figuring out who's going to get the best shipping routes in an ice-free Arctic. It's trying to prevent an ice-free Arctic. And unfortunately, that notion seems to have been missed by a lot of people.
Right, exactly, because they're looking at it as something to exploit. And speaking of which, it's not just shipping. We're talking about oil and gas exploration, possibly destroying the seabed, looking for rare minerals, and overfishing of the fisheries. The last probably great stocks of fish left. Right, exactly, because they're looking at it as something to exploit. And speaking of which, it's not just shipping. We're talking about oil and gas exploration, possibly destroying the seabed, looking for rare minerals, and overfishing of the fisheries. The last probably great stocks of fish left. So it almost seems like it's a spark that could not only set off a real acceleration in climate change, but also World War III.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Doesn't it show how little we continue to learn that part of the response to seabed becoming accessible because of climate change is to get excited by the possibility of getting more of the fossil fuels that caused that climate change in the first place. It's just baffling to me, just absolutely stunning how that can possibly be a response. But there we are.
Well, let's hope your book contributes to changing that situation for the better. Kieran Mulvaney, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about your book, Arctic Passages, Ice Exploration and the Battle for Power at the Top of the World. Thank you.
Good. Thank you so very much. I really, really appreciate it.
In addition to Arctic Passages, Kieran Mulvaney is the author of The Great White Bear, A Natural and Unnatural History of the Polar Bear. Next week, we'll be talking with world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann about the new book he co-authored with infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Hotez, Science Under Siege. It's all part of our programming for Climate Week that starts on September 20th. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.